I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. A faction of the Taliban in Pakistan claimed responsibility for a suicide attack at a park in Lahore on Sunday. More than 70 were killed, more than 200 injured, including children who were playing in the park. The group reportedly said it was targeting Christians who were celebrating Easter. Just a week ago, ISIS claimed responsibility for attacks in Brussels, Belgium, that killed more than 30 and wounded an estimated 300 people. They're responsible for other acts of violence in the Middle East, including a suicide bombing in Istanbul a few days before Belgium. There are still unanswered questions about a terror attack in San Bernardino, California, killing 14, carried out by a couple in December who were killed in a confrontation with law enforcement. Earlier this year, Boko Haram attacked a village in Nigeria, firebombed homes, and killed 86 people in another act of terrorism. Today in Radio Times, how do people become radicalized to carry out such violence? We have three people who have joined us, two in our Philadelphia studio. Clark McCauley is a research professor of psychology, co-director of the Solomon Asch Center for the Study of Ethno-Political Conflict at Bryn Mawr College. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Sophia Mosalenko. She's a researcher at START. That's the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, and it's based at the University of Maryland. They co-authored a book a couple of years ago, Friction, How Radicalization Happens to Us and Them. Sophia Mosalenko, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us by telephone is Anthony Lemieux, Associate Professor of Communication and Associate Director of Global Studies Institute at Georgia State University, lead researcher in the Transcultural Conflict and Violence Program. And Tony Lemieux, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Tony, let me begin with you, only because we've sort of half started our interview here before we went on the air with my guest here in the Philadelphia studio. Why is it so hard to predict who is going to be a violent terrorist?
Well, that's like one of the huge questions that we grapple with, of course. And, you know, the issue is that there are so many potential factors. There's lots of different motivational causes. And for some people, certain things, you know, really tend to click more than others. And so it makes it really difficult. I mean, in hindsight, you know, it's very, you know, it's possible you can always kind of look backwards. But to actually have any predictive validity, it still is exceptionally challenging to even come close.
Is that also because while it does feel as if there is so much terrorism there compared to the world or our own population, there are so few people who actually are terrorists that they are hard to study, Tony?
Well, that's true. And it's also true that a lot of the same kinds of environmental factors or personality features or things that, you know, people kind of point to and look at as potentially causal features, you know, people could have those, and some people might choose to go with different kinds of pursuits or outlets. You know, it really doesn't necessarily lead to these particular array of personality or environmental factors causing terrorism in every single case of the people who experience those. So there's other things that are part of that which have been more elusive for us to really put our finger on. And again, in a, you know, forward-predicting
right.
sort of way. We can look back and find them. We can look back and tell the story. And Clark and Sophia did a great job of that in Friction, which is one of my favorite books on the topic. But to make it be something that we can use to predict accurately is still hugely challenging.
Well, let me go to our guests who are sitting here. To you, Clark McCauley, is there a kind of mindset that we need to understand? And I ask that because thinking about this attack in Lahore, targeting a park, a playground where children are playing as they do in parks all over and playgrounds all over this country. Is there a certain kind of mindset that would help us understand that kind of attack?
Well, Ariel Mirari, who has probably talked to more terrorists than anybody, says that the common mindset of terrorists is a kind of a 10 minutes to midnight feeling. Things are desperate, and desperate times call for desperate remedies. So that's the closest to a mindset character that I can think of. But as Tony says, the real problem is that there are so many different kinds of motives. Some
sure.
people have a political grievance. Some people are looking for revenge, for a personal grievance. Some people want the power and the status of having a gun or a bomb in their hands. Some people join a militant group and get involved in violence because somebody they love asked them to. So there are just so many different ways to come to the same behavior that, as Tony says, it makes it very difficult to try to make a prediction. And as you say, it's very rare in the whole range of human behaviors. Terrorism is rare.
Right.
So whenever you're trying to predict a really rare behavior, you got a really uphill problem.
Sophia, let me ask you to expand on what Clark just said about this sort of sense of desperation. If we're going to try to get inside the head of a terrorist or the mind of a terrorist, what is that desperation about?
Well, terrorism is a tactic of people who feel that they are an outnumbered, persecuted, unfairly treated minority. Whether or not that belief is founded in facts is a different story, but usually they create an ideology, you may call it, or, you know, a story that tells their history in terms of, you know, here we are, this giant government is after us, the people are calling us names, we can't get anywhere in this country, and the only way to get ahead is to do something drastic.
To get ahead, to get attention.
To get their goals achieved. Yeah.
What is the goal? Again, I'm back to the what happened in Lahore. What is the goal?
For some of them, it's global caliphate. For others, it's maybe representation of their agenda on the table of world leaders.
I think for many, it's a feeling of agency. If you've
power, you mean?
You have a history of feeling helpless and victimized. To be able to strike back at the enemy as you see the enemy, even if you don't succeed in anything else, you have been able to take action. You have removed yourself from this feeling of helplessness. And human beings don't like to feel helpless.
No. Tony, let me go back to you and help us understand then the role of grievance. And I know that you have looked at that. I guess, you know, many people have grievances. They don't necessarily go out and terrorize people. Some people have peaceful protests because of a grievance that they have. Can you flesh that out for us?
Well, indeed, that's been one of the areas of our research. And, you know, there's different kinds of grievances. And, you know, all of us have grievances on, you know, fairly regular basis. You know, some more serious than others, some more sustained, some that are directed at us personally, some that are directed at groups we belong to just because of, you know, membership in such groups or social categories. So there are a huge number of grievances that are potentially relevant here. Those that we've really started to look at over the past few years in our research really involve humiliation as a particular form, discrimination. Political exclusion is another that, you know, we look at, as well as physical repression and physical harm, so really kind of violation of the person. And so that's part of the story. The other piece of it, though, that I think is important is that, you know, if a particular individual is really especially aggrieved or oppressed, sometimes that leads to, you know, as Clark was saying before, that kind of sense of helplessness. It can also lead to a withdrawal, a kind of, let me just kind of put my head down and try to make it. Let me try to protect my family. One of the things that I think is important is that personal sense of grievance, you know, is one that we look at, but also think about how people experience grievances on the basis of others, that sense of kind of empathy or even altruism that, you know, I recognize that there is something going on to this group that I am part of or that I want to be part of. I need to do something about it to rectify it. And if people start to feel that addressing that grievance is a personal obligation, that can motivate action. But again, that can also motivate protest. In fact, in our own studies, we found that grievance, you know, really also motivates peaceful forms of action and, you know, desire for change that is addressed using peaceful tactics. So it's not just that the experience of grievances leads people to violence, but it's one of those factors that certainly shows up a lot. And I'll wrap this comment up. but it shows up as a huge element in various propaganda outlets as well. You know, really kind of speaking to those grievances, harping on those grievances is something that we see extensively across different groups.
And I do want to pick up on that because I know that plays such an important role. So I understand the grievance. I understand the humiliation, the idea of feeling like an outsider. So why then attack people at an airport who have nothing to do? They're not members of a government. They're not the people that are necessarily excluding or humiliating people, or again, children playing in a playground. Why the civilian targets? I'm to you, Clark.
Usually terrorists who attack civilian targets believe that their own people, the people they care about, have been attacked as civilians. So, you know, a lot of people fighting with and for ISIS believe that the West in general and the U.S. in particular has been doing violence to Muslims in the Middle East and in other Muslim, predominantly Muslim countries for decades. So, you know, one really important thing to realize about terrorism is it's an action and reaction dynamic that goes on over time. It is the perception of what they do that changes us. And that's why the title of our book was How Radicalization Happens to Them and Us, because radicalization happens in the context of a back and forth action and reaction between two groups. Usually for terrorism, one group is much, much weaker than the other. And so they end feeling like the only way we can respond to the violence that's been done to us is by inflicting violence on them. They have to learn what it's like.
They meaning civilians. I know you want to add to that. Go ahead, Sophia.
There's another explanation also that we found in detailed case history of a Russian terrorist group, People's Will. When they transitioned from attacking government officials to attacking civilians, their reasoning was that civilians were passively supporting the government, that they are guilty by association, and because if only they had said something or done something to prevent injustice, to stop unfair treatment of whoever it is that the terrorists are claiming to fight for, the situation would have changed. But because they're ignorant or indifferent, that's why they deserve to be attacked.
That they're, in a sense, complicit.
Exactly.
Because
they refuse to see the injustice inflicted on Muslims in this case.
Jihadists will tell you that the West, Western citizens in general and U.S. citizens in particular, are complicit because, and they actually believe a good thing about us, it's a democracy, they say. You vote for these people who make these decisions. That means you are responsible for their decisions.
Well, we are talking about terrorism, trying to understand the psychology of terrorism. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about the psychology of terrorism. Our guests are Clark McCauley, research professor of psychology, co-director of the Solomon Ash Center for the Study of Ethno-Political Conflict at Bryn Mawr College, Sophia Mosalenko, researcher at the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, and Anthony Lemieux, associate professor of communication and associate director of the Global Studies Institute at Georgia State University. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Tony, if I can go back to you and just again talking about the targets of terrorism, they tend to be civilians. So terrorist groups, I mean, they don't take on the government directly because they probably would lose. They take on people who cannot defend themselves because they don't even know this terrorist attack is going to happen. Again, I'm trying to get inside the head here, the mind here. I mean, are we talking about people who feel, who are, I don't even want to use the word cowards, but feel as if this is the target that I'm going to get the most attention for because these are people that cannot defend themselves?
Well, there's multiple things going on that I think are important to understand. It's a little bit more nuanced than that. And just kind of picking up where we were before the break, one of the other things, it's not only that it's a democracy, but in the cases of Western countries especially, it's that you are also taxpayers. So not only do you vote for it, but you pay for it. So there's a real kind of logic that's put forth, which essentially is to say there is no such thing as an innocent civilian. So that's the first thing that I think we have to understand, that that's part of the kind of perspective that is going on here. The other thing is that it really is designed where the target of the attack, the particular individual who is harmed or killed in an event, is not necessarily the target. The target is the much broader, you know, public. It's the people who will then start to have a lack of confidence in their leadership. It's the power for that sort of targeted violence to really be spectacular in a way that changes political outcomes, that changes policies, that gets things to really start to happen. And so it really is designed to generate that kind of response that then, you know, really then leads to additional sorts of change. Like, so we saw that in the case after the Madrid bombings, for instance, that, you know, that actually influenced an election outcome.
Right.
So there are things like that.
So the,
that we can point to.
The, and I'm, you know, I'm struggling with this because I want to understand it, and I realize there are limits to our understanding. Back to you, Tony, then. So the targets, the people who die in terrorist attacks, they do not exist as people for the terrorists who carry out these attacks? They have dehumanized them?
Well, I think that's, you know, in certain cases, that's certainly going to be true. And so we see that also with kind of the intergroup images that are used to portray particular groups or categories of people. But it is essentially that they're not given that sort of full consideration, or is back to the point that, you know, that Clark talked about before, it's viewed as justified. It's viewed as not only justified, but in fact, it turns into a moral obligation. You have to go strike out. You have to go do this. You have to make that sort of effort, and you may lose your own life in the process. In fact, that's, you know, something that's that's an additional premium is placed upon in many instances as well.
Well, let me go back to you, Clark, because if we're talking about ISIS here, my understanding is that most of the people that have been targeted and killed by ISIS are Muslims. So they're not necessarily people that live in democratic countries. So let's factor that in. What justifies that?
Well, you're right that it's a whole different piece of business. What ISIS does in Syria and Iraq and what it supports and encourages in terms of violence in Western countries. In Syria and Iraq, what's really going on is the Sunni, who used to be running the place in Iraq, have been turned around and made subservient, a minority they always were, but now they're as they see it, a victimized minority, victimized by the Shia. So the big selling point for Sunni in Syria and Iraq is that ISIS is the only defense they see they have against the power and the humiliation that comes from Shia. Now, that's a whole different piece of business than why a Western Muslim would go to join ISIS, or why a Western country Muslim would mount an attack of violence in a Western country. So it's worthwhile recognizing that the motives and the concerns of the people in ISIS-controlled territory is a whole different piece of business than what happens here in the U.S., for instance.
Sure, or in Europe as well, and other,
or in Europe.
Or other countries as well. Can we, Sophia, I mean, can we call these people psychopaths, or does that miss the point?
There are psychopaths among them. There are some notable ones, like you may remember Zarqawi, who terrorized Iraq for a while. He seems to fit that profile. But most of them are, quote-unquote, normal people. In fact, some of them may be a little more sensitive and have a higher than usual capacity for empathy. They respond to suffering more than an average person does. We call this kind of person who turns to terrorism a caring, compelled type of terrorist.
Wow.
So they watch videos with Muslims on them being victimized by, Israeli checkpoints or some other situation, and they feel so strongly about this that this can radicalize them, make them turn to terrorism.
Can anyone be a terrorist then? I mean, are we all at risk for becoming a terrorist?
Yes, I think that's right.
Under the right circumstances?
We are under the right circumstances, because at the bottom of terrorism is love. Everybody who cares deeply for somebody else, whether their own family or their larger group, their country, their ethnicity, their religious group, anybody who loves strongly can react with violence when they see bad things, victimization, harm, hurt, happening to those they care
about.
It's a
weird kind of love, though, isn't it? I mean, it's a love that allows, that gives someone permission to...
Or even, as Sophia was saying, more than permission, requirement, a moral requirement.
Sounds like you want to add something, Tony.
Yeah, I think one of our colleagues has an exercise, a thought exercise that kind of sums this up, and it says, you know, is there anything that you can think of that's worth dying for? And people, you know, would raise their hand and say, well, of course. And that could be different things for different people. And he says, is there anything that you can think of that's worth killing for? People could raise their hands. And if those two things happen to, you know, coalesce, that's we're starting to get into that space a little bit. And so it certainly is the case that, you know, the people have tremendous capacity to do great good and really heroic things, and also capacity to do tremendous harm, and really things that, you know, outside of the immediate context, people can recognize as horrible. I mean, so any instances where we look at things that are really almost unfathomable, you know, genocide being probably one of the key examples,
sure,
you see these kind of building blocks of very kind of mundane, normal, you know, relatively normal social psychological processes. Differentiation, a lot of the things that kind of compound that come from external factors, environmental or economic challenges or otherwise, but at the root of it, there's, you know, these basic kind of categorizations that people engage in routinely that just really seem to go off track. But when you really reverse engineer it, there's a lot of really kind of, you know, relatively normal processes that are part of that, you know, intergroup violence.
You want to add to that, Sophia?
I want to disagree with my colleagues.
I'm not sure
that everyone is equally capable of becoming a terrorist. And the reason that I think that is because what I think is uniquely different about terrorists is their capacity for action. Because as we know from research that we conduct and other people do, there are a lot of Muslims, both in the U.S. and in Europe and in Muslim countries, who agree with the most radical statements. They support suicide bombing in defense of Islam. They have a favorable opinion of ISIS. They think that it's a moral obligation of every Muslim to travel to Syria to join ISIS. And yet it's a very small proportion of these people who ever do anything of the sort. And I think for most people, there is a great barrier, you know, between, you know, wanting to kill somebody, which maybe we all sometimes do, or most of us.
You think about it, perhaps.
Right. And actually doing anything in that direction.
Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Sophia Mosalenko. Also with us is Anthony Lemieux, Tony Lemieux, and Clark McCauley. And all three of our guests have studied terrorism, helping us understand what motivates a terrorist. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Lots of comments here, Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Rich from, looks like Haddonfield. Rich, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Sure.
What rarely gets addressed about discussions regarding Islamic radicalization is the contents of the Quran. Global and national leaders, as well as the news media, find it seems anathema to state the obvious, that the contents of the Holy Quran, the perfect book of Islam, really foments and inspires jihadists. My question is, how do we counter the numerous supremacist, intolerant, violence-inducing statements that constitute three-fifths of the Quran without alienating Muslims who choose to ignore those statements?
Well, Rich, let me take your comment, and let me just shift it slightly, at least to, as I put this to our guest, Clark McCauley. How much do you think religion in and of itself, Islam or other religions, are the influence on how a terrorist thinks and then acts?
Well, I have to disagree with our caller. I think the influence of anything like abstract ideology in religion is very small. What is true is that no normal human being, and as Sophia says, most of our terrorists are normal human beings in psychiatric terms, no normal human being kills others without having a story of why they're doing it, why it's justified, why it's necessary. That story can often include reference to something about religion or, you know, back in the bad old days, it could have been maybe Marxism or communism as an ideology that justified violence. So, yes, you will hear people telling a story and they will often make reference, terrorists will, to some larger ideology. But the cases we look at and the more we study, the more we think that this tends to be more of an after-the-fact rationalization. After people feel compelled to act, and maybe after they've started acting violently, then they produce a story. And indeed, I would say it's a kind of a human condition that most of us are better at producing justifications for what we do than doing what we find reason for. The latter is virtue.
Virtue.
And virtue is not in all that heavy of supply.
Tony, you want to add to that?
Well, I think that's a critically important set of points, and I would add that it's also what people tend to focus on very selectively, and you know right now, a lot of the kind of dominant discussion is you know looking at you know the Quran and Islam, but we certainly have comparative approaches that we can look at over time and space and you know history and see different religious traditions and how the kinds of themes are very selectively kind of attended to or brought forth. It would be kind of as if you know, we were basing for the Christians among us or Jews, if we were kind of focusing really on just the very narrow reading of, say, Leviticus, you know, that would lead to some really awful things. So it's kind of, I think, really important to recognize that as in a much, much broader context.
Rich, thanks for the call. Let's see what George from Wayne has to say. And George, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead, George.
Yes, hi, good morning. One of the things I find quite disturbing is that your discussion is almost exclusively focused on the terrorism that results from Islamic extremism and to the exclusion of terrorism as use of violence towards political ends. If your discussion is strictly focused on Islamic terrorism, excuse me, I think you should speak of it in that context. Groups such as the white extremist groups, such as the Ku Klux Klan, have been committing terrorist acts and have been terrorists for over 100 years. And if we are only looking at terrorism as this brand of Islamic terrorism, we're going to miss out all of these acts of violence that are being committed right here in this country, such as the shootings at the Sikh temples and such, and other acts of terrorism by Timothy McVeigh and others that will be committed as we undergo the demographic changes that are happening in this country, and there are groups in this country that hate it and don't like it. So my question is, isn't terrorism more so, if we don't look at terrorism more so as something that is really trying to destroy a government or a society or to suppress a specific group of people or group within that society, it's trying to disrupt or destroy it versus trying to participate in it. And I think that a key difference or something that needs to be looked at is that, yes, people have grievances, and yes, some go out and protest and so forth, but the difference between one who is trying to commit an act by suicide or whether or not they commit suicide, even if they just plant a bomb or something, is that in one case, one is seeking to disrupt, destabilize and destroy, and the other is seeking to actively participate and
sure,
be a part of.
Sure, sure. Now, Georgia,
change to participate in.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and you're absolutely right. We have focused a lot on Islamic terrorism, but we did not want to exclude talking about the kind of terrorism that has happened in this country, the KKK, I think being a perfect example of the kind of terrorism that they committed on African Americans in this country with lynchings. I mean, we have our own history here. Clark, do you want to add anything to that?
It's absolutely right that if you had to choose in the U.S., which is a greater threat, right-wing terrorism or some kind of jihadist-oriented terrorism, you should pick right-wing. But the recent news has got us focused on just one of these. And indeed, we have to recognize there's a left-wing terrorism. We had in our book examples from Out of the Weather Underground, a left-wing terrorist group right here in the U.S. of A. in the 1970s. And there is today a left-wing terrorism, Animal Liberation Front, for instance, Environmental Liberation Front. These groups, these people commit terrorist acts, usually not as violent as the against people, but very effective terrorism against property. So terrorism is a tactic. It's open to anybody. Through history, lots of different groups have used it. The caller is absolutely right to recognize that.
I'm looking at something that was in the New York Times. The main terrorist threat in the United States is not from violent Muslim extremists, but from right-wing extremists. Just ask the police. And then they quote some information from the Police Executive Research Forum looking at the number of attacks, and most of them were anti-government extremists. We do have to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We are talking about how to understand terrorism, how do people become radicalized to carry out violence, and again, talking with Anthony Lemieux, with Sophia Mosalenko, and with Clark McCauley. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with our guests about how people become radicalized, whether it's possible to predict who is vulnerable to militant messages. Can terrorism be prevented? We didn't even get to that yet, but let me quickly reintroduce them. Sophia Mosalenko, researcher at START. That's the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, based at the University of Maryland. Clark McCauley, research professor of psychology, co-director of the Solomon and Ash Center for the Study of Ethno-Political Conflict at Bryn Mawr College. They co-authored a book called Friction, How Radicalization Happens to Us and to Them. Anthony Lemieux, Associate Professor of Communication, Associate Director of the Global Studies Institute. That's at Georgia State University, a lead researcher in the Transcultural Conflict and Violence Program. Lots of people that want to join the conversation. Tony, let me go back to you. And we didn't spend a lot of time talking about the suicide bomber, I mean, the person that's willing to kill themselves in order to kill others. And it always struck me is that you don't see leaders of these groups doing that. They send out other people to carry out these attacks. Help us understand, I guess, the relationship between the person who sends someone to do a suicide bombing or suicide attack and the person who actually carries it out.
Well, in many instances, I mean, you've got these very interesting dynamics between leaders and followers. Some of the groups have much more charismatic leaders than others, known for their kind of humility and stature within the movement or the organization. So we certainly, you know, we have that. Certainly examples like the PKK or even the Shining Path. So we can look at different examples, again, you know, doing a comparative work over time and space, and you see that sort of dynamic where there's maybe a different sort of set of rules that are involved, but the leaders definitely have to do things to generate that status. But if I may, I'd like to go back to the previous point of the last caller, because I think that's really a critically important area, you know, with regard to an overfixation on Muslims and terrorism at the expense of actually recognizing where the bigger threat is. And in fact, some of our own research, my group, we've done experiments to really look at how and when people perceive terrorism differently. And, you know, that really came in the wake of the Kansas City attacks, where Frazier Glenn Miller is, you know, being apprehended and yelling Heil Hitler. And the first thing I thought was, had this guy been yelling Allahu Akbar, we'd have a very different narrative. We'd have different levels of coverage. And based on that event, we designed some experiments to test that, which we conducted over the last year. Now, after we had finished collecting some data, looking at, you know, the differential effects of identity of perpetrator and such, the Charleston attacks happened. And to me, that really marked a difference in the way that the attack was considered. Even John Stewart comes on and says, call this terrorism. It was really the first time, you know, in my memory that an attack like that wasn't just referred to as the kind of the shooter or the gunman or something. So we collected additional data after that and are really trying to answer that empirically. But the report you cited, some of the research that our colleagues do in terms of surveying police, and even, you know, these examples that we fail to kind of notice and label as such, like, you know, when some so-called patriot movement, you know, somebody goes after, you know, police or the sovereign citizens. This is what law enforcement views as the biggest threat because they're armed to the teeth and they've got the ideology there. And so I just wanted to echo that point and thank the caller for that.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. A comment from Nancy says it's not just who becomes a terrorist. It's a question of what kind of person gets other people to be terrorists. I've seen a lot about the first, not much about the second. Sophia, can you answer Nancy's question about, I guess this is about the recruiting process.
So it's about a lot of things. It's about freedom of speech, right? Because if there is someone who's very influential, who, let's say, preaches certain violent actions, it's a question of what to do about it. If they are on the American soil, what to do about them if they are abroad? You know, there have been attacks on influential imams abroad that specifically targeted them because they were so influential in turning people to violence and to jihad.
And we have a First Amendment in this country.
Yes.
You can say things.
Right. So it's about, you know, we don't know much. Unfortunately, psychology can't really say much about what charisma is, what makes someone capable of moving people to such drastic actions. So there are a lot of questions and not a lot of answers.
Yeah. Clark, anything you want to fill in there?
I think often it has to do with an intense small group dynamics in which people act and react to one another in a small group and they compete for status. And status goes to the person who has the most extreme view, who is ready to risk the most and do the most. So under these circumstances, it's a very low-level kind of leadership. It has to do with relations amongst people in a group, and it's the group dynamics that I would point to as the source of the radicalization as opposed to imagining that there is one member of this group who is pushing all the rest.
I mean, that's the kind of power of the group, right?
That's the power of the group as opposed to the power of some one particular individual in it.
And do you think different terrorist groups compete with each other?
No doubt about it.
To sort of whatever, up the ante, or if you do this, we're going to do that?
Yes, to get the status of being most extreme, most violent, most successful. I mean, ISIS is competing with the remains of al-Qaeda. And basically, most observers, I think, today would say ISIS is competing very successfully. Al-Qaeda is in the shade. ISIS is the place to go. If you want to join the successful violent group, you should join ISIS.
Tony, what do terrorists fear? What are they afraid of?
It's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of things that could be part of that. If you're thinking about it from like an organizational perspective, it's, you know, the fear, I think probably one of the biggest fears is being irrelevant, of not mattering, of not being impactful. And so a lot of the efforts are targeted to really generate that. What we know from some of the documents seized in the Abbottabad raids, bin Laden really feared the kind of tarnishing or the dilution of the al-Qaeda brand that he had worked so hard to conceptualize and build. There were rifts with, you know, between him and Zarqawi, for instance, which was the, you know, Zarqawi's group ultimately kind of morphed into what we now call ISIS. They have different kinds of fears depending on, you know, the group. But I think that it's hard to say, you know, the threat of kind of physical punishment of death isn't always, you know, the most compelling. In fact, that might actually be perceived as one of the rewards that someone is trying to earn through their kind of membership or their actions. You know, so I think it really kind of depends on a, not quite a case-by-case basis, but not too far off of that.
Well, Clark, let me just pick up. You talk about the power of the group or this group identity. Would it be fair to say then that someone who is attracted to these kinds of groups has a, what, weak identity, has identity problems, looking for some kind of identity outside themselves that makes them feel worthwhile?
It is true that an individual is more vulnerable to joining some kind of a militant group if that individual has recently lost their social contacts. They lost maybe their one dear parent. They lost their romantic partner. They lost a job. So we call this situation unfreezing when an individual is cut loose, especially suddenly, from the kinds of everyday social activities and rituals and contacts that keep most of us normal most of the time. So that's one way that an individual can be made more vulnerable to joining one of these groups.
We have a question from Robert. He says, is there any similarity between the thinking of a terrorist and those who actually commit suicide? Is it giving up in some sense, hopelessness? I mean, do people, Sophia, do kill themselves? It has nothing obviously to do with terrorism. Is there some kind of connection between a suicide terrorist and someone who commits suicide?
So Ariel Merari did a great study in an Israeli prison where he basically analyzed a number of people who almost became suicide bombers, but something stopped them. Either the bomb didn't go off or they were intercepted right before they were going to blow it up. And he compared these terrorists with non-suicide bomber terrorists.
Right.
And, you know, he made them go through all kinds of psychological tests, you know, traditional, more, you know, esoteric. And basically, you don't see a difference in depression. You don't see a difference in suicidality. Mm. There's very little that you see, and that is in the domain of what we call personality disorders. So they're not these disabling psychological problems like depression or schizophrenia or bipolar. It's something that makes you who you are. You're born with it, and there's very little one can do to change that. And it turns out that people who are suicide terrorists in this study are more likely to have dependent personality disorder, meaning they need someone in their life to attach themselves to take ideas from, and so on, and also avoidant personality disorder. So they are not very good at forming connections with people. But as far as suicidality, there's no empirical support for that.
Let me see what John from Morristown has to say. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, thank you so much for a most enlightening program.
You're welcome, you
and your guests and the questions.
Thanks.
Are the authors familiar with Alan Fiske's work on virtuous violence, his latest work on social relational models, this underpinning of acceptance of the legitimacy of violence?
Well, John, let me see. Actually, Tony, let me toss that first to you. And are you aware of this work or understand what our caller is talking about?
I'm not familiar with that specific work, but the general concept, I think, is one that I think we see, you know, across the board, where something becomes, you know, virtuous and necessary. I mean, even from, you know, the moral disengagement perspective and work, and even some of the groups that really, you know, take a more apocalyptic approach, of which, you know, ISIS is certainly one, where, you know, violent action is required to usher in some kind of new era of improvement or change. We see that with the apocalyptic groups like Aum Shinrikyo as well. We haven't really talked about that kind of category of groups just yet. But so if I understand where the question was going, I think there's certainly evidence for that, although I'm not familiar with the particular work that he cited.
I think Clark is.
I think of Alan Fiske as a friend of mine. He was at Bryn Mawr for some years. And I know of the book, and it's in the pile toward the top of my pile of books to read, and that's where I am.
Fair enough. John, thanks for the call to Radio Times. An email for Anne-Marie. Group dynamics and charisma aside, it's the economy, stupid, must be considered. I don't think terrorism flourishes in economically healthy, politically stable societies. I mean, we have our own terrorism in this country, and while individuals might not be enjoying the kind of economy that we have in this country, do you think the economy explains it, Sophia?
I think terrorism thrives on division in any society. They you know, their goal is not just to destroy buildings, property, and to kill people. They want to destroy a society's way of life, to make us change how we live, to make us abandon our values. And in that sense, any kind of an internal division and conflict is something that they're happy to exploit. That being said, I don't see economy as a particularly fruitful pursuit for terrorists. In fact, you know, I think ethnic divisions and religious intolerance is more of an avenue that they're aiming for, judging by, you know, what they do.
Tony, let me go back to you. I'm looking at the clock here, and we've talked about how people get radicalized. How about the de-radicalization process, the idea of terrorists seeing the, what, error of their ways or deciding that they're not going to do these acts anymore? We certainly have heard about people that gave up by themselves of their own accord. But what do we need to know about how to de-radicalize some of these people?
Well, I think we have to think about it as a multi-phase problem and then intervene accordingly. And the good news is there's been tremendous effort on this front, and we're starting to see some evaluation of various programs come out that suggest that there is some potential efficacy, but it has to be kind of targeted correctly and phased correctly. So if we're thinking about someone who's starting to kind of feel that sense of alienation or frustration, and I've got to do something about it, oftentimes there are behavioral tells, you know, different, you know, things that people in the immediate social network, you know, friends, families, parents pick up on and say, something's going on here.
Right.
And so there's a point for intervention there. And that's really like a primary prevention sort of approach where you can try to intervene early and create some kind of alternate arguments. There's a lot of talk about counter narratives and such, but really kind of providing a more compelling alternative. Then there's people who have actually actively started to engage in various ways, and that's where it takes a little bit of extra work. And then finally, the people who have gone and engaged and for whatever reason want to leave. Those reasons, we know, are often like disillusionment. You know, this wasn't what I signed up for. I signed up to be part of this glorious cause, and here I am, you know, doing clerical work or some other kind of, you know, inglorious thing. And so there's definitely accounts of that we know. Then the challenge is, how do you really exploit those and intervene accordingly?
We're almost out of time here, Clark. I know you want to say something.
A very important distinction in de-radicalization is between de-radicalizing ideas and opinions on the one hand, as opposed to changing action on the other hand. There are people who will stop violent action, but who still believe all the things that they used to believe. And then some people give up both the extreme ideas and the extreme actions. But it's really important to having before you clear, what is it I'm trying to do? Am I trying to change people's opinions? Am I trying to change people's actions? And this has a parallel on the radicalization side because, as we pointed out a couple times, there's 100 people with extreme ideas for everyone who ever acts. So you've got to have a clean distinction in this whole phenomenon. You've got to have a clean distinction between radical ideas and radical action.
We're going to end on that note. We could go on much more to talk about. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Clark McCauley, thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
Co-director of the Solomon Asch Center for the Study of Ethno-Political Conflict. That's at Bryn Mawr College. Sophia Mosolenko, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Researcher at the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. And Tony Lemieux, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's
You're
great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Associate Professor of Communication at Georgia State University. That's it for today's edition. No, that's it for the first hour of Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.